Now we turn to Europe and the capital of neutral Sweden. David Anderson is just starting to report.
His purpose was to try to buck up his cohorts in arms on this, the second anniversary of the signing of the Tripartite Pact. There is no doubt, for what if von Ribbentrop's accounting could be accepted verbatim, the facts he presented were impressive. In words which left little to be desired in the way of superlatives, he painted that diamond-studded path which would lead to an Axis victory. Significantly enough, he began by talking of the United States. He said that the Tripartite Pact was formed as a warning to the United States to keep out of the European war. He went on to speak of the Russian front, of the tremendous human, material, and territorial losses which the Russians had suffered, and of the losing battle which the Russians are fighting. He spoke of the exhaustion of the Russians, and said that the battle for Stalingrad would end in a German victory. He tried to explain the secure position of the tripartite powers, militarily, economically, and politically. He spoke of the British bombing of German cities, and of the impossibility of an Allied invasion of the European continent. He ended his speech by saying that time was now working for the Axis. That, in brief, was von Ribbentrop's speech. More significant almost than the speech itself was an interview which von Ribbentrop gave to foreign correspondents prior to his meeting the other representatives of Hitler's horde. In this interview, he tried to compare figures between the Axis and the Allied potential power. 420 million people are now working for the Axis, he said, whereas the Allies can count on 250 million at the most. From the standpoint of production, he scoffed at the figures released in Washington and New York. It would take a population of between 3 to 4 billion, he said, to produce what America promises this year. We in the Axis can talk in astronomical figures, but not the Allies. He said that the Axis had sunk 9 million tons of Allied shipping during the first 9 months of this year, and that this figure would reach 12 million before the end of the year. On the other hand, he placed the maximum Allied shipping production this year at 4 million tons. He spoke of the fighting spirit of the Americans and said that the United States, a conglomerate of 35 different nations, had nothing to fight for. The Axis, on the other hand, was fighting a life and death struggle for living space. So much, then, for Joachim von Ribbentrop. Let's look now at what he didn't say. He didn't tell his Axis partners anything about the failure of the German summer offensive. He avoided mentioning the fact that the Wehrmacht was scheduled to have taken the whole of the Caucasus and to have begun their attacks on Leningrad and Moscow long ago. He seems to have shown ignorance of what his partner in crime, Goebbels, has already released for publication in neutral countries about German losses and about the exhaustion of the German army in and around Stalingrad. He purposely left out the account of the resistance of the occupied countries to German domination. Something which you in America know only too well. He showed a complete ignorance of the productional potential of the United States or of the fighting spirit of the American people. This list could be extended, but I'm sure that you yourselves can fill in the other omissions. This is David Anderson returning you now to New York.
For the latest developments in the British capital, we take you now to John McVane in London.
Good morning. This is London. A single German plane dived through the clouds today and laid a stick of bombs on workers' houses in an East Anglian town. Some people were killed, and rescue workers are still searching for victims trapped in the wrecked buildings. That's the only air news in Britain today. This weekend, four cabinet ministers and an archbishop all talked about the post-war world, the need for doing away with bad social and economic conditions, the need for building a more enduring form of national and international society. Most British commentators give high approval to this attempt to portray the problems and the opportunities. The authoritative London Times believes that American spokesmen like Vice President Wallace and Mr. Perkins have taken this line of thought further than anything yet attempted in Britain. The Trade Union Daily Herald says the British Labour Party has a magnificent opportunity to help create this new world. Much of what was said this weekend was very vague. Certainly the government must give the British more concrete evidence of the new world before it can arouse the enthusiasms of the great mass of people in this country. Only one or two commentators take a cynical turn. Today's London Evening News, for instance, points out that General Wavell made a very realistic speech on war strategy this weekend. The news says the man in the street will have to follow Wavell's road past signpost after signpost before he can begin to follow the weekend idealists into the country beyond.
That's true. But most British people are also thinking about the future while they're working at winning the war. Mr. Wilkie in Russia and General Wavell in India talked realistically of the Second Front. The British like that kind of talk, but most of them realize that the sacrifices a Second Front will bring must be sacrifices toward a better life in a better world if they are to have any real meaning. The naval correspondent of the London Daily Herald today expresses the belief that Germany is planning a spectacular big naval move. He points out that the German Navy suffered a blow to its prestige when the big Allied convoy went to Russia without being attacked by the German naval units in Norway. This expert believes that to regain some prestige, the German Admiralty may suddenly send out into the Atlantic the Tirpitz, with perhaps the battleship Scharnhorst, a couple of pocket battleships, destroyers, and cruisers. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
And now to the Russian capital for the report of Robert Magidoff. Go ahead, Moscow.
This is Robert Magidoff speaking from Moscow. The Germans are now trying to break up Stalingrad into a number of isolated sectors and to take them one by one. This only goes to show that Stalingrad has proved too big a mouthful for the German army, so the only way they can now hope to swallow and digest it is to take it piecemeal. With this new plan, the Germans have advanced twice in the last 24 hours, but the defenders of Stalingrad have upset this to some extent by recapturing two streets yesterday and by inflicting heavy losses. It remains to be seen yet whether the besieging army will swallow Stalingrad or Stalingrad will swallow the besiegers. In the meantime, the savage pressure of the Reichswehr and the Luftwaffe has remained unrelaxed, and German reserves are continually arriving by air. The Russians, too, keep pouring in supplies and reinforcements, sending them by day and night across the Volga in troop ferries, gunboats, and armored cutters. And this in spite of the German bombs, shells, and mines that are being rained down on these fast, fearless little warships. The air of Stalingrad is thick with dust, and it's never given time to settle on the city's smoldering ruins. The ground under one's feet there is quivering as though in the grip of a continuous earthquake, and the very waters of the Volga are troubled as if by subterranean shocks. The heroic defense of Stalingrad has spurred on the workers and farmers all over Russia to redouble their efforts in producing for the front. Reports keep coming in showing that production plans for the first three quarters of this year have been fulfilled and in many cases overfulfilled. Goodbye from Moscow.
Late developments in our own national capital are reported now by Richard Harkness, speaking from the newsroom in Washington.
The week-old fight in Congress over the president's price control bill appears to be all but over this morning. The big four farm organizations have virtually collapsed, and it seems certain that Mr. Roosevelt will get his broad authority to stabilize food costs at around 100% of parity. Enough senators bolted the farm bloc over the weekend to assure adoption of the administration's compromise amendment. So Majority Leader Barkley plans to press for a vote on the Senate floor this afternoon. Now, under the compromise, the president may fix all farm prices, taking into consideration the increased cost of farm labor, where the extra money farmers now have to pay for farmhands would create gross inequalities. The amendment gives Mr. Roosevelt practically unbridled power over food costs, so it's certain that the compromise will be acceptable to the White House. But it's still doubtful whether Congress can complete action on the whole bill by Mr. Roosevelt's October 1st deadline. Chances are that the president will give the Senate and House an extra day or two. And Washington's immediate interest of the war centers this morning on Wendell Wilkie and Mr. Wilkie's statement urging the United States and Great Britain to open a second front now to relieve Russia. From all indications, Wilkie's statement won't induce our military leaders to speed up their second front timetable, because there's a growing belief here in the capital that Russia will be able to hold out. And second, there's every indication this country is pushing toward a second front as fast as it can. Now, tying in with the second front, Senator Taft of Ohio says he'll introduce an important bill this week, a bill providing appointment of a manpower czar, a government official with full authority to allocate American men to the armed forces or to war industry or to employment on our farms. Taft said that our growing labor shortage, particularly on the farms, demands immediate action. And the Truman Committee steps into the manpower picture. The Special Defense Investigating Committee meets this morning to study the problem. Brigadier General Hershey will be the first witness. The Truman Committee thinks the manpower problem is one of such vital war importance that it's holding its hearings behind closed doors. And that's all from Washington.
This has been the News of the World, reported by George Thomas Foster in Australia, David Anderson in Stockholm, John McVane in London, Robert Magadoff in Moscow, and Richard Harkness in Washington. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
Good evening, everyone. This is John W. Vanderkirk speaking for Alka-Seltzer, bringing you the news of the world. American offensive blows against the Japs in the Pacific have again flared up in fiery action. In the Solomons, there is a suggestion that the constant hunt for Jap land troops through the hills and the rainforests has now spread to other islands. In the past 3 days in that same region, the flyers of our three services have destroyed 42 more Nip planes and damaged three others without a single loss. Other U.S. bombs in the Solomons have also lately hit two more enemy cruisers and probably sunk a merchant ship. Also last week, though we just now learn of it, a force of United States Army heavy bombers accompanied on one raid by Canadian planes twice attacked the Japs' dangerous handhold on foggy Kiska Island at the far end of the Aleutian chain. Two enemy submarines were gunned from the air. Seven Jap seaplane fighters were blown forever into uselessness. And two anchored transport vessels were hit by U.S. bombs. And now a word from Charles Lyon.
Will you listen for just 39 seconds to something about that job of yours? You know better than anyone else just how important that job is to you and how important it may be to other folks, too. So for the sake of keeping your work as good and as accurate as it should be, keep a package of Alka-Seltzer tablets handy on the job. Then, if a headache or a touch of acid indigestion should threaten to slow you down for a while, you'll be all set to enjoy the quick, welcome relief Alka-Seltzer can give. Get a 30 or 60 cent size package of Alka-Seltzer from your druggist and keep it where you work as well as at home. Thousands of others do. And now, the news of the world.
Stalingrad is a long city. Much of it was built in and around and replaced the old imperial Russian city of Tsaritsyn under the Soviet second five-year plan, that period during which Russia reached industrial maturity and built the magnificent foundations for her resistance in this war. In Stalingrad, therefore, the huge blast furnaces and tractor plants and steel rolling mills came first. The favorable location of those factories along the high west bank of the Volga River and at points of easy access to the eight main highways and the three railroads which served Stalingrad, was the main consideration. The rest of the city, much of it less than 10 years old, was built largely simply around those heavy industries. For that reason, the metropolis, named after Steele and the Soviet leader, spreads over many miles, some 20 of them up and down the river. The actual heart of the town is about 4 miles square. Today, though they do not specify, the Russians concede that there are upwards of 36,000 German troops actually inside that city. And more Nazis are being rolled in, are creeping in behind the cover of the broken walls, and are being dropped by parachute from transport planes with every passing hour. So it can hardly be said now that Stalingrad is any longer under siege. The city itself has become the frenzied battlefield, in which every hallway is a scene of fighting, every cellar an artillery or a machine gun nest, and every roof a fortress. All attackers dread that kind of close infighting in the labyrinth and clutter of a broken town. And the Russians say the Germans are paying dearly for an average loss of at least 2,000 dead each day. At some points, the invaders have beaten their way forward. In other sections, the Red Army has forced the Nazis back. The balance of gains is still on Hitler's side. But any immediate decision of that great engagement tonight seems no nearer than it has for many days. Lately, as you may have noticed, the News of the World commuters have been singularly active. Just recently, Martin Agronsky came back from Australia. Still more recently, Alex Dreyer, once of Berlin, briefly passed this microphone on his way to England. And now, here at this small table, which is a kind of radio crossroads of the world, is Robert St. John, who, if you'll forgive my saying so, has been our brilliant and humanly sympathetic reporter for the past year in London. He's thinner than he was, but otherwise looks fine. So go ahead, Bob St. John in New York City.
Thanks, John. 48 hours ago, I was still in Britain, in another world. Tonight, I'd like to paint a picture of that world. Over in Britain, millions of people have been living in the fringe of hell for 3 long years now. In the big cities, vast areas are waste and desolation. You don't hear much about it, but every day and every night, Nazi sneak raiders come over and machine gun peaceful village streets and drop bombs on hospitals and trains and buses. Just before I left, Britain was warned that this winter, Nazi stratosphere planes may be dropping bigger bombs than ever on England. The British are not going hungry, but eating is something you don't do for pleasure over there anymore. While America is asked to get along on 2.5 pounds of meat per week per head, the British are rationed to 0.5 pound a week, and that may be cut this winter. Britain today is one vast armed camp, almost everyone in uniform of some kind. When I went to London last year, the only American troops were a handful of Marines guarding the embassy. Today, if you strike a match in the London blackout, you're almost certain to see an American soldier not far from your elbow. Piccadilly, Leicester Square, little village streets all over Britain teem with American troops. In Britain, men and women, yes, and mere children too, are working as much as 12 hours a day. And America might as well know that Britain has just about reached the peak of production. Any further increase in United Nations output must come from America, because Britain just hasn't any more manpower to draw on. But despite all this grimness, the spirit of the British people is something amazing. A year ago, they were still in the we-can-take-it mood. Gradually, that's changed into a real offensive spirit. Everywhere you go, they ask one question: when are we going to invade Europe? Yes, Britain is ready to give it as soon as the military brains say the word. And now let's backtrack the route I've just traveled and listen to John McVain in London.
Thanks, Bob. This is London. Nothing is known in London yet on the German claim about the Atlantic convoy. Weather in Europe is still a war secret. But a couple of hours ago, it was announced that RAF planes on a sweep over France on Saturday afternoon had to abandon the operation because of cloud and severe icing. 11 planes were missing. Tonight, all over Britain, thousands of young women celebrated a birthday. The fourth birthday of the Women's Army, the Auxiliary Territorial Service. After the day's work was over, commanding officers cut birthday cakes. And the girls who'd been in the service for 4 years told stories of the months after Munich when they drilled in civilian clothes, and people joked about the idea of a women's army. They don't joke anymore about women at war. Not in this country. Tonight, on lonely hillsides and in big cities, ATS women are standing by anti-aircraft guns. In hundreds of tents, those women in khaki are playing a man's part in this war. And the girls at those parties tonight were really celebrating the fact that their army, on its fourth birthday, is all grown up. You notice darkness is coming quicker in Britain these fall nights. The blackout curtains blanket windows more and more early. Movie theaters are preparing to close earlier so people can get the last train or bus. Some London stores will begin advancing their closing hour on October 1st. And by November 1st, all London stores will close at 4 in the afternoon. The winter may be a cold one for many British homes. Some political quarters believe the coal situation is so bad that the government will have to bring in drastic... The government hoped the country would cut down on coal consumption and save 10 million tons a year. But the voluntary economy doesn't seem to work. Tomorrow, thousands of young men between 18 and 25 will learn that they can volunteer to work in the coal mines instead of entering the fighting services. Only physically fit men will be taken. Most of them will work at hauling the coal to free more experienced men for the skilled job of digging at the coal face. To save fuel, St. Paul's Cathedral and Westminster Abbey have cut out their evening services. And now this is John McVeigh in London, taking you to Upton Close in Chicago.
We have a very lively Pacific roundup today, from Kiska at the top of the arch of the Pacific to India beyond that arch. Significant about the lively time we gave the Japs at Kiska Thursday and Friday last are the cooperation of our neighbors, the Canadians, first time reported on this sector, and the predominance of seaplanes our airmen got, indicating that Japanese efforts are to use Kiska primarily as a base for seaplanes, a weapon which has thus far played but small part in this war. Dropping down to Japan, we hear Tojo's warnings to the Nipponese people of a completely new shape to the war for them. Whether this means for them to be prepared for bombing from America or from Siberia or for a diplomatic offensive on Russia or on India or even an attempt at a truce with China is not disclosed. The Japanese warlords simply tell their people to be ready for anything. Going down the other side of the Pacific to the bulging coast of China, we see three attempted Japanese thrusts out of the walled city of Kinhua, or Jinhua properly, nipped by the alert Chinese armies which are beleaguering this town, whose name means golden flowers and which is famous for Chinese cured hams and tea and as the birthplace of General Chiang Kai-shek. Further south in Indochina and to the west along the old Burma Road, which the Japs are trying to reopen as an invasion route, American air forces, serviced by the Chinese ground crews and intelligence, are really making life miserable for the invaders. Five separate groups of Jap barracks were peppered yesterday. Inland in the free China capital of Chongqing, gala preparations were being made to welcome Wendell Willkie. And Madam Chiang Kai-shek herself will do the honor of being his interpreter. If I know the lady, she'll give him considerable to think about, too. And Secretary of State Hull's statement that the American government is alert for new developments in India, implying political developments, renews hope, or at least possibility, of some straightening out of that deplorable situation which confuses friends with enemies in Asia. If the friendly auspices of the United States can be used, the timing of Secretary Hull's statement with Wendell Willkie's arrival in Chongqing, which can very properly be called the allied capital of Asia, may be significant. Now from Chicago, we take you to Morgan Beatty in Washington.
The war joke's over here, too, John McVeigh. And finally, after 3 weeks, we can give three cheers. Congress and the administration both face the bedrock facts of American life in wartime today. The real issue back of the farm problem. It's manpower and where we're going to get it to win. Tonight, Chairman Paul McNutt of the Manpower Commission publicly announced, it's been known officially for weeks, by the way, that a careful administration study of manpower legislation is underway and recommendations will be made in the near future to the president. McNutt's already told Congress in testimony that mobilization of all of our manpower is absolutely essential, so we have a pretty good idea that he'll recommend a super czar to control the flow of human energy for war, a control that every nation in the struggle, democratic or otherwise, has found necessary. It's just barely possible that Senator Bob Taft, the hard-headed Republican from Ohio, forced McNutt's hand because Taft threatened today to introduce his own bill to name a manpower czar. If the Taft bill should get the green light, Congress would be able to steal a march on the administration and write its own ticket on manpower, even though both tickets look very much alike at this distance. A super czar over both the McNutt Manpower Commission and the Hershey Selective Service System. Meanwhile, Draft Director Hershey, the man who runs that selective service system, says he'll find a way to get essential help to essential farmers as soon as the Agriculture Department or some other responsible agency tells him what kind of farming is necessary. "I am fully prepared to act," said General Hershey before a congressional committee, "without examining the law too carefully to see if I have the power." Those are pretty powerful quotes. And that's all from Washington at for now.
John W. Vandercook will return with some more late news in just a moment. Meanwhile, a word to the housewives. Keeping a home running smoothly, getting meals for a hungry family and the socks darned and the clothes washed and ironed is no small job. And it's a bigger job when you have a headache or when your muscles feel stiff and sore. So, ladies, here is my household hint for today. It's keep Alka-Seltzer handy and take it when you want prompt, pleasant relief in a hurry.
Alka-Seltzer can make your work seem easier just as it can for anyone else. And it also helps keep you the cheerful sort of wife and mother you always want to be. Try Alka-Seltzer the next time, won't you? It can make a big difference in the way you feel. Now, back to the newsroom.
Moscow, a Soviet reporter in Turkey, has just learned that the Italians are now constructing coastal and inland fortified lines along the southern coast of Yugoslavia. Italian officials who are superintending that job of concrete pouring across the Adriatic from the Italian heel and the fascist heels say that it is a measure of defense against local patriots and also against the possibility of an Allied seaborne invasion, which might just come someday to an ardent welcome on that coast. And that's the news of the world. This is John W. Van der Kolk speaking for Alka-Seltzer. Until tomorrow at this same time, goodbye from the newsroom in New York.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.